Major Arthur Flint, Reel 7. You were saying, Major, about getting off from the chemical warfare.
Oh, yes. well, I was... we received a letter, which I then appointed the GSO3CW to 8th Armoured Div. And I didn't like this very much. The battalion was then at Colchester, had a hell of a send-off, and arrived in Leeds, where the 8th Armoured Div was forming. And the general in charge of the Major General was Major General Dick McCreary, who ultimately became a Lieutenant General and took over from Montgomery and one thing and another. But he then was a Major General and had, obviously, he was a 12th Lancer and had service in France and so on. And I was interviewed by him on joining, and he said... He was somewhat hesitant in his speech. He said, you're coming, you're supposed to be the expert in chemical warfare. I don't think we need bother with this. It's a complete waste of time. I want you to forget it. What I want you to do is to take charge of the tactical reconnaissance with the RAF. Will you do that? Or you will do that. No question of option. So really, although I was a GSO3 chemical warfare, I never did any bloody chemical warfare as such, except in little tiny pieces when it came up. And I did this TACR with the with 8th Armoured Div. I then, as a result of that, as a result of one or two other things I did with the 8th Armoured Div, including arranging an enormous cross-country run map reading exercise on the South Downs for the whole division, I might say, incorporating feeding them and a bathe in the afternoon on the beach, bearing in mind the beaches were mined and we had to arrange for the chaps to go down through these gaps in the minefields to bathe in the sea, and then get them all off back to the back home again. It was a fantastic piece of organisation, even though I said it as shouldn't. But I then got selected to go to the Staff College. And I left the 8th Armoured Div, went to the Staff College, and I arrived on the doors of the Staff College with my kit and so forth. And they said, Flint, no, you're not on the list. So I must be. Okay? Oh, no. Anyway, they sort of said, oh, you better see the adjutant. I saw the adjutant. He said, no, you've been taken off the list. I said, what do you mean I've been taken off the list? He said, my instruction is to send you back to the 8th Armoured Div. You've been selected for another appointment. Well, bloody hell, you know, I wanted to do the Staff College course. In those days, I decided the best thing I could do would be a regular officer after the war if I could, assuming I survived. So I was interested in sort of getting on with it. Anyway, I went back to the 8th Armoured Div, and having just had a farewell party, I might say, only, you know, the night before, look at a right twit. And they said, oh, yes, the instruction of the War Office has come down that you're to be sent on a special attachment to the New Zealand Army in New Zealand. And you're to go up to the War Office tomorrow to get your instructions. Oh. And I said, well, I didn't particularly want to do that. I said, never mind whether you want to do it. You've obviously got the qualification. You've been selected for it. You'll get the Staff College. You'll be appointed GSO2, which is the next grade up in Staff Major, and be promoted Major. You, in fact, will be made a Staff Officer without going to the Staff College. And, you know, you've shown you've got the sort of capabilities, or such capabilities are required. And so there's no argument, off you go. I went up to the War Office, and they gave me the gubbins of what they wanted done. And basically, it was to take charge of their tank branch in New Zealand. And they packed up enormous boxes of bloody books and so forth for me and promised them, you know, from various instructional centres. And they said, you will leave in about 4 to 5 days' time. I said, well, what about my family? Well, you know, they'll stay behind, but you could inquire from movement control whether they can go, you see. And I went down to see the movement control in the War Office, and there was a particularly fiery sort of Scots major. He obviously a First World War chap. He'd lost one eye, got a big black patch on his eye and a wonky leg. And I asked him, could I take my family to New Zealand? I then got a wife and two kids. I got a most imperial bollocking for suggesting it. You see, ridiculous, no families travel in wartime, don't waste my time. And that was all I got. Well, then myself and another chap called Jack Greenwood, we were both going to New Zealand, we had to appear in front of the New Zealand liaison officer, Brigadier Park, in New Zealand House, to be sort of vetted, just looked over to see whether he thought we were suitable.
Had you been told why you'd been selected for this job at all?
Well, only briefly. We were to do I was to do a staff job in the New Zealand Army headquarters, and Jack Greenwood was to go to their staff college.
But why had you been chosen to?
They didn't say why. I'd been selected to do the staff college course in England. They wanted staff officers so badly they couldn't wait for them to be trained. So all those that were deemed suitable for appointment had been deemed, you know, to have the qualification, if you like. And they didn't wait. In my case, they didn't wait. They just said, right, you know, you've got the buddy job, and off I went. At least that's as it was put to me. We appeared in front of this new Brigadier Park, and he said, oh, yes, have you got any family? Yes, a wife and two kids. I expect you'd like to take them to New Zealand. I would indeed, but I think it's only fair to tell you I applied at the War Office. They told me it was impossible. No families travel in wartime. Oh, I don't know, he said. We'll see what we can fix, see what we can arrange for you. So he picks up the phone and says, get me the War Office. And he gets through, and he asked to speak to somebody about sending people to New Zealand. And he pretty obviously got through to the bloke that had given me a bollocking only about a couple of hours beforehand. And I could hear, you could hear on the telephone somebody saying, rattling away there. And old Brigadier Park, he was a wonderful chap. And his face got redder and redder. And he said, if that's your attitude, I will arrange it myself. Good day to you. Bang! And he slammed the telephone down. He said, gentlemen, your families will go to New Zealand. I personally guarantee it. That's how they got to New Zealand. Otherwise, they'd never have gone. And I was there for, oh, that was 41. And then we sort of got tried to get the New Zealand Army ready for invasion against by the Japanese.
Can you say something about what you're actually doing with these New Zealanders? How are you training them?
What did I do when I got to New Zealand?
Well,
they said they wanted somebody to run their tank branch, to take charge of it and see that the training was as it should be, and generally do the army headquarters end of the thing, rather than the... There was an AFV school as well. They had their own tank school, and they brought chaps back from the Middle East to, you know, as instructors. New Zealanders they were, but it was very elementary, because the New Zealanders as such had got no tank-trained people in the Middle East. So what had happened, they'd taken certain chaps out of the New Zealand army who they reckoned were getting over age or had a gut for. They put them into the AFV school at Abbasia in the Middle East and given them about a fortnight's course there, and then send them back to New Zealand as so-called instructors in gunnery and DNM and all that sort of thing. And there was a regular tank corps chap called Basil Groves, who was the OC of the AFV school. There were the three of us in New Zealand, all told. And I ran the army headquarters end of it.
What did that consist of?
Well, you might say that's a good question. I was responsible for a lot of things, but among other things, advising the sort of GOC, General Puttick of the New Zealand forces, as to what, you know, the training of the forces should be. There had been a liaison visit. Some general had come over and made various recommendations, and this was the application of the thing. And I really came under the Brigadier General Staff, who was Brigadier Stewart. how Patrick was away quite a lot. It was Stuart who was the real man who did the work. And we had 9 armoured regiments, a tank brigade, an AFV school, and there was this part of the New Zealand Staff College. And I had to see that the 9 armoured regiments had equipment, that their training was such, you know, that they were properly trained, and that they were doing the individual training that they had to do, and tactical training and so forth. And they were mostly New Zealand TA soldiers. A lot of them were conscripts called up, but they were bloody good people. And in conjunction with the AFV school, we put on, you know, courses for them, and courses for officers were arranged at the staff college. And I went round all the armoured regiments, a job I didn't particularly like, but I had to report on the OCs of the unit as to whether I thought they were suitable or capable or not. I didn't like this business, you know, going and being entertained by the colonel and sort of coming away and saying he was no bloody good. I mean, that wasn't in my book at all. And I tended to fight away from that, but there were one or two of them that were pretty obviously, well, good people, if you like, but really much too old. I mean, about as old as I am now. And they would never have stood the, you know, never stood the racket. This up to a point was brought out in the New Zealand Div, when the 3rd New Zealand Div, in the Solomons, when they'd send everybody home who was over 30 years of age. Anybody over 30, finished. They wouldn't even consider them, from lieutenant colonel downwards.
What equipment did they have when you were after this period?
This again is... there was... This is another thing that I was responsible for, was ordering up equipment for training, and also for getting the mobilisation of scale of equipment, of tanks and so forth, and ammunition, that was required to equip these 9 armoured regiments and the tank brigade. In effect, it meant taking what we were given, because most of the stuff was allocated by the people in America. What the hell do they call them? Chief of Staffs. It was a military mission in America, who were taking charge of the stuff that was produced in America and allocating that around the place. And of course there were also the tanks and so forth that were made in England that were shipped out to us. And really we had to take what we were given rather than ask and be given. All those spares and so forth we did demand. The tank brigade was equipped with Valentine tanks, Valentine 3s and Valentine 5s. Number of close support Matildas, and we got a job lot of American General Stuart tanks. They were an abortion because something had gone wrong in the production manufacture, and they got the hulls of one mark of tank with the turret of another mark of tank stuck on the top, and the two didn't bloody match, and none of the electrical fittings and so forth fitted. It was chaos. So really, they were better than nothing in that you could drive them about, but you couldn't operate them as a tank. And I forget how many we had of those, quite a lot. Oh, best part of 100, I think. Anyway, the tank brigade was slowly being equipped with these Valentines. And then the Americans, we had the Americans in New Zealand. They they came into New Zealand and they launched the attack up into the Solomons, Guadalcanal and so on. And that was launched from New Zealand and Australia and so on. And one of the things we had to do was to give training facilities to the American forces that were in New Zealand, their tank people. That was quite interesting, quite illuminating. And
why was that?
Well, they were quite pleased to have sort of facilities, but they were very conscious of the fact they were mostly regular Marine American soldiers or American people. They were regular people as opposed to volunteers or conscripts or anything like that. Well, there was a proportion of them there. I won't say they knew it all, but they they tried to give, up to a point, give that impression. They didn't, you know, you couldn't tell them anything. They just told you what they wanted, and if you had it, you know, they'd take it, and if you hadn't got it, well, they didn't bother, that sort of line. And one of the things they wanted, I was told that they, anything we had in New Zealand, they could have the use of it, either in training land or AFV school or guns and tanks or anything. And I saw the, I forget who his name was now, he was a general in the Marine Corps anyway, and told him this, which I think he knew already, and said, what did he want? And said, well, what have you got to offer? Said, well, the AFV school, gunnery school, put the chaps through the tank ranges, if you like. Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah, we'll send some of them up. Can I send some of my chaps up there to see what you've got to take charge of it? By all means. And I went up there and met these chaps, and there were a couple of officers and some warrant officers, and they got some Shermans there. And I hadn't seen a Sherman before, in all fairness. And they got a gyro stabilizer on the thing for the gun. They said, oh, it's a wonderful thing, firing on a move and hit anything, you know. And you don't have to do anything, just point it in the right direction, hits the target, this sort of line. I said, you know, this I must see, it's good. And they had this Sherman up on this on these ranges at Waiuru, and we ran one of the targets across. It was a tank. It was on a frame behind a bank, and it was towed on a wire with a cable, ran on a trolley, and the target was on the trolley who fired as it went along, about 600 or 800 yards, something like that. And they fired at it. They fired about 10 rounds. Never hit it once. So what do you think of that? I said, no, you haven't hit it. Oh, yes, we have. Bloody good shooting. I said, what do you mean, bloody good shooting? You never hit the target? Well, go out and have a look at it, you see. Oh, no, well, I said, what do you mean by hits, you see? I said, well, you've got to hit the target. Oh, well, if we're near it, that counts. I said, well, doesn't count in our book. We've got to actually knock it down to say you've hit it. Otherwise, just hitting near it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't matter a thing. Well, you know, that's the best we can do with the equipment. And I said it, and they said, well, you were talking about, you know, hitting things on the move. You can do any better than that. I said, you try me. And we waddled up one of these old Valentines, and I must admit, I took about 20 minutes to test and adjust the sights to make sure it was right. And they put the target up, let fly with 5 rounds, and I put 5 rounds through the target. I wouldn't say I put it through the middle, but I was at that time I was a trained gunnery instructor. And I was determined to bloody well do it, and do it I did. But up to a point, it didn't make all that difference. You know, oh, wow, you know, that's what we've got, and that's what we've got to put up with, and that was it. So off they went. But they weren't... They had a lot of equipment, but it wasn't that technically superior to ours. I think our British tanks could have wiped the socks off the American ones. The only trouble, when I say the only trouble, the Americans started, of course, where we left off. And they were designing their tanks, and we were still fiddling about with, you know, 2-pounders and so on. They went up to 75 mil. And went on to, we were of course designing 6-pounders and 17-pounders. They were on the stock, so they went straight on to 17-pounder, 75 mil and 17-pounder with their Shermans.
At their AFV school that you were involved with, was the pattern like at Bovington, the sort of DM courses?
Yes. It was, you know, based on that. They did courses for drivers and fitters and so forth. There was a tactical training too at the AFV school.
Well, what was that based on, the tactical training? What were they doing?
Well, infantry tank cooperation. And this again, I say the trouble, everybody was learning, you see, the war was going on, and they're learning the hard way. And lots of these New Zealanders who'd come back to New Zealand had been in the Western Desert battles as infantrymen, and had the shit shot out of them, and seen British tanks, you know, blasted over by 88s, like so many, you know, sparrows at a fair, and they didn't reckon that the British tank tactical doctrine was all that, you know, was all that hot. And they had their own very decided views as to how it should be done, and in fairness, they were right. And this was more the line that was put over in the AFE school and in the staff college than any of the, you might say, the British diagrammatic teaching and training, which was the official line at that particular time.
And was that British training the sort of stuff that you took with you in those books?
Well, what sort of yes and no, because the at that time I was in the 8th Armoured Div, and we were Pucker Armoured Regiments. When I say Pucker Armoured Regiments, we also, or say we, the British Army had also suffered a hiding in France, where something similar to this had taken place, and the Western Desert Doctrine was also being fed down at a fairly high level to Britain, and the way in which the thing should be done, well, not always right, but a lot of new ideas as to how a tactical doctrine as to how it should be done were coming down, and a certain amount of it had permeated into, you might say, into the 8th Armoured Div before ever I left the United Kingdom. In fact, they said, I'd been talking about infantry tank battalions and cruiser tank, or infantry tank regiments, or infantry tank battalions and cruiser tank, or armoured regiments. Well, this cruiser and infantry tank business went out because often they had to use the cruiser tank in the infantry tank role, and they had to use the infantry tank in the cruiser tank role. And this was obviously a nonsense, and because neither was suited, you know, for that specific role. So, well, they then tried to develop a tank which would do both. And I wouldn't really like to say that they've really achieved it. I wouldn't say that they've really solved it now. They had the Centurion. Now this is post-war. I'm talking post this war, and the Centurion is a pretty good tank, but it's been outdated by the Chieftain, and I've seen the Chieftain, and I've seen it fire, and it fires a very tidy brick. And I wish to God we'd had a Chieftain's in 1939. We'd have whacked the shit out of them all. But and this is a thing that I remember saying when I was in the WDs, when we were in this sort of formation series. I will never be satisfied until I sit in a tank which has got about 2 foot of armour plate on it and fires a gun like a telegraph pole. Now, if you like, that's a bush way of describing it, but that was what I felt was what was necessary to really achieve success with tanks. And I won't say the Chieftain is a got 2 foot of armour on it, because it hasn't. But it's certainly got a hell of a sight more armour on it than ever we had in those days. And it does fire a gun which has got a hell of a packet. And this is what is necessary. I also think that the anti-tank devices, which are now available to armies throughout the world, is such that there's not a lot of future in fighting in tanks in this day and age. I think they've got their purpose and their use, but they won't be the sort of queen of the battlefield that they were in at Cambrai, that sort of thing. Times and things have changed considerably.
How long did that the training period in New Zealand
when was it? That went on, and then once the Americans had gone into Guadalcanal and pushed the Japs out of Guadalcanal, it was pretty obvious that, you know, they were going to win. And they decided that they would cut down the troops in New Zealand. There were three divisions consisting of the 9 armoured regiments, and they would disband those, and they would send the troops as reinforcements to the 2nd New Zealand Expeditionary Force in the Middle East. And they would also form They would also form a third New Zealand Div, which would fight with the Americans in the Solomons. We would put a complete division in, which had this tank force in, it's known as the 3rd New Zealand Div, the Special Tank Squadron Group, which when I say I designed it, I drew up the establishment for it, and I drew up the G1098, which was a scale of equipment. And they had everything that I could think of that was, you know, necessary and proper, including an armoured bulldozer. Now, an armoured bulldozer was almost unheard of, you see, but they had one. You know, we got a bulldozer and armoured it ourselves. I must tell you that it got whipped off the unit as soon as it got to the Solomons, but they went in with it. They had it to start with. As a little aside to what they also went on with, things were never on the G1098, we had a lighting and charging set, which provided electric light and also would charge batteries. Said we must have, you know, some of these to charge the tank batteries and so on, keep them up. And I scaled up for these, and I scaled up with sufficient to provide lighting, electric lighting in the camps of the unit when the unit was in some form of camp. We also provided pumping sets, which were in theory were for washing the tanks down. Well, if we washed the tanks down, we stuck them in the river or put them in the sea. Rarely did they get hosed, but they made excellent bath equipment for the soldiers to wash in. They also had washing machines. Now you might say, what on earth, you know, how did that come about? The British Army has never had a washing machine issued to it in its life, as far as I'm aware. It certainly didn't at that stage, but the Americans had them. And I said, right, if the Americans have got them, we should have the same, in order that we can be on the same administrative level as the Americans' units we should be operating with, and got away with it. So they had about half a dozen washing machines. Everybody washing their Dovey in these washing machines, and all the other poor sods slamming them against stones in the river. It's only, you know, it's what it should be. And I did, when they decided that there was little chance of the Japs invading New Zealand, the whole thing sort of caved in. And I was offered the option of going either back to the UK or to the Middle East, or I could go with a New Zealand division if I wanted to.
What did you
and
think?
And I opted for that.
When, by the time that you set off, in fact, for that, what did you think their standard in New Zealand Armoured Force standard was, comparison with, say, what you'd see to the tank regiment in England?
It was good. It was good. They were good gunners. They were certainly good drivers. Mark, they were wonderful people for improvising, the New Zealanders. They were farmers, mostly, and on their farms out in the back blocks. I mean, there are no garages or workshops or anything like that. If the tractor goes wrong, they have to repair the tractor themselves. And if they hadn't got a piece to put into the tractor, they sort of made it then and there, you know, filed it up the hard way, that sort of thing, to get the thing going. Well, they applied the same ideas to their, you know, to their tanks. And they certainly did very well.
What about their tactical standard?
Their tactical training. Now, you see, taxing the jungle, this was something that started off from scratch. And I spent a lot of my time, and so did the